to the TGIF edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody Cederstrom, who I'm pleased to say is due back on the air this coming Monday. Can't wait. In the meantime, as always, for your gold and silver needs, please call Carla or Mary Ellen toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you my opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today is Friday, January 17, 2020. Thanks again in advance to our producer and engineer, Todd. Let's get started with the market report. Gold was up again today, corrected a little bit toward the end of trading, still up $4, about 0.26% at $1,557. Silver up 8 cents, 0.45% increase at $18.08. Platinum up 1.6%, 16 bucks at $1,025. And boy, palladium just continues its meteoric surge, up another almost 7% today, 149 bucks, closing at $2,582 an ounce. Now, much as I hate to say it, we're really not sure what drove the precious metal market today. Despite the recently signed Phase 1 U.S.-China trade deal, however, long-term uncertainty surrounding that does exist. Plus, there's plenty of other news about U.S.-EU trade tensions, budget deficits and a national debt, impeachment, and so much more. So, with all the uncertainty and geopolitical volatility, indeed, certainly putting some continued upward pressure on the precious metals. Now, oil was actually up and down today. We've got domestic crude oil finished up about 0.27%, about $58.68 a barrel. Domestic, international Brent crude also up about 0.5%. At $64.96. I should say that gold futures ended up another 0.4%, selling at $1,557. Now, the CBOE VIX Volatility Index, bear with me here, I'm going to here, where are we? Down about 1.8%, finishing the stock market trading day at about 12.1. At the same time, the fear and greed index holding steady today at the extreme greed level of 89. In the paper markets, looks like all domestic and global stock markets were up today. In the U.S., the Dow Jones was up just about 2.2%, up $49 and change, closing at $29,348. We'll round that up. The broader S&P 500 index up 0.4%, $12.8 points to close at 33.30 on a rounded basis, and the NASDAQ up a little over 0.3%, 31.81 points, closing at just about 93.89. Certainly another decent week for U.S. equities. All U.S. Treasury yields were also up. Oh, I see. Never mind. Excuse me there. It looks like the two-year just dropped 0.001% to 1.567%. the bellwether 10-year yield up 0.018 to 1.827, and the long-term 30-year note up 0.27 percentage points. That takes it to roughly 2.29 percent. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's DGS Market Report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, we'll get back to treasuries and the bond market in a minute, but first, the Treasury Department released eye-popping numbers this week showing that the federal government's budget deficit is on course to cross the $1 trillion mark in fiscal 2020. And yet, nobody seems to care. You know, the government ran a deficit of $357 billion in the first quarter of the new fiscal year ending in December, and it's on track to reach $1 trillion this fiscal year for the first time since 2012. Calendar year 2019, in fact, was the first year to touch $1 trillion since 2012. As a result, Treasury has been expanding its debt issuance to cover a deficit that has been rising every year since 2016, including, most notably, a plan to issue a new 20-year note, which we'll talk more about in a minute. If interest rates went up for a couple of months, people would say this is getting more expensive. That was rate strategist Michael Schumacher. He added, right now, they're not focused on it, and that's one of the reasons why you have none of the political candidates focused on it. They don't care. The market's not penalizing them for it either. Well, strategists and economists in general say the ballooning deficit doesn't really matter as much as it did when unemployment was high and the economy was weaker. The government, for its part, says unemployment is now at decade lows, five-decade lows, and interest rates are historically low as well, though higher than most other countries, making U.S. Treasury yields quite attractive for investors. Now, not too long ago, members in both houses of Congress would have been bickering about high spending and high deficits, and of course, squabbling over spending and deficits has shut down the government more than once. Some economists say that deficit hawks are now an endangered species in Washington. During President Obama's administration, Republicans worked hard to contain the deficit, insisting on rigid caps on spending. More recently, however, not only have those caps been raised, but the 2017 tax cuts sponsored by Republicans were funded mainly with additional borrowing. Still, no one expects a day of reckoning in the near future. Bank of America analysts say the cost is more subtle. Heavy government borrowing diverts private saving away from private investment. This weakens trend growth in the economy, they say. The house looks fine on the surface, but deficit termites are undercutting the foundation. Those analysts point out that Washington's not even focused on entitlements, like Social Security and Medicare, which are the fastest growing part of the budget. Those expenditures have been off the table for some time. It's clear that both parties will keep the spending spree going as well. The White House announced this week it's likely to push for further tax cuts later this year. It is, after all, an election year. And Democratic candidates have proposed major infrastructure spending and other expensive policies like student loan forgiveness and Medicare for all giving rise to the annual deficit and national debt. The budget gap widened 26% in the fiscal year 2019 that ended September 30th to $984 billion. That was an increase from $779 billion in fiscal year 2018. The deficit has been growing from a low of $442 billion in 2015. Historically low interest rates globally are helping to mask the situation for the time being anyway. With negative rates in Europe, the U.S. is having no trouble funding itself at low interest rates, despite its large borrowing appetite. Some studies argue that U.S. debt is reaching levels that have gotten other countries into trouble in the past. But it seems like decision makers think the U.S. has more room to run. Some economists believe the U.S. has more leeway than other countries because the dollar is still the world's reserve currency, and the U.S. thus is at the center of global financial markets. Be that as it may, we all could be in for a brutal surprise someday soon. Now, speaking of bonds, treasuries, the U.S. is likely to see solid demand for its first sale of 20-year bonds in more than three decades. That's according to investors and analysts who commented today. Their comments come as the Treasury Department looks for fresh ways to raise revenues in the face of the yawning budget deficits I just talked about. The decision announced by Treasury yesterday comes in the heels of a years-long effort by U.S. officials to assess investor demand for various potential bond issues, including 50-year and 100-year bonds. Now, some investors apparently were surprised by the timing of yesterday's announcement. While the introduction of the 20-year bond has been widely expected, a lot hadn't expected it until later on this year. Several older vintages of Treasury bonds maturing in 20 years, which could see weaker demand with the arrival of the new debt in their midst, saw the largest jump in yields on the day this was announced. One of the reasons they're targeting the 20-year sector is that it's a natural source of expanding demand, particularly from some of the liability-driven investor community. The U.S. is looking for ways to expand its debt options as its financing needs grow due to ramped-up budget spending and less tax revenue. Primary dealers expect the Treasury's borrowing needs to grow to $1.2 trillion in fiscal year 2022, up from $1.1 trillion this fiscal year. Other countries, including Japan, the UK, France, China, and Australia, already issue 20-year bonds, while the US, Germany, and Canada do not. The obscure Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee, TBAC, that's a group of banks and investors that advise the US on its borrowing strategy. Well, they said in October that while the sale of the 20-year bonds is likely to weigh on demand for 10-year notes and 30-year bonds, it would also reduce the need for the Treasury to increase the size of those auctions. The government stopped issuing 20-year bonds in 1986 after the debt suffered from liquidity issues, with the yields paid on the debt being higher than those of the longer-dated 30-year bonds for much of their five-year lifespan. Today's Treasury market, however, it's a lot larger. The broader range of investors and more modern trading processes. Demand for yield has also surged, with many bonds in Europe and Japan now trading in negative territory. Now, the Treasury is also expected to introduce a one-year floating rate note that's linked to SOFR, S-O-F-R. That's the new benchmark rate that was selected to reduce the role of the corrupted London interbank offered rate, LIBOR. Treasury has further said it's looking at new inflation-linked debt and ultra-long bond options that I mentioned earlier, 50, 75, even 100-year bonds. Excuse me. The introduction of a 20-year Treasury will also likely encourage companies to sell debt at that maturity, private companies, where there's currently little corporate supply due to the lack of a comparable Treasury benchmark. There's apparently a tremendous amount of demand for a benchmark 20-year, especially as it relates to credit. The 20-year part of the Treasury yield curve currently offers relatively better value than other maturities, though this gap could close as demand increases for those bonds. Now, we'll keep you in the loop as the year goes on, and certainly let you know how we expect the U.S. and global economic scene to affect these bonds and in turn affect precious metals. So then, worried at all about your debt? Well, counting intragovernmental borrowing, the U.S. is now $23 trillion in the red. The country owes over four times more what it did in 2000, when the national debt stood at just $5 trillion, just. How do we get to this point? Well, like any budget that you have in your household, we have too little income, too many expenses. Our biggest expenses as a country include Social Security, Medicare, defense, and the interest on all that debt. The rising debt surely poses major risks to our economy. For example, it could leave the government with less spending power in a major downturn, a lot less. On the other hand, some like Ted Jenkin, who's CEO of Oxygen Financial in Atlanta, believe it could also have some positive implications for personal finances. Specifically, he says, interest rates aren't likely to rise all that much in the coming years. That's because if rates were lifted to 5 or 6% or more, the net interest on our national debt would actually be the number one line expense in the federal budget. We literally suffocate ourselves to death, Jenkins said. Today, the 10-year Treasury, as I reported earlier, is around 1.8%. Still, the government expects that it will pay out almost $600 billion in interest to our bondholders in 2019. So does the continuation of low rates mean for personal finances? Jenkins said it will remain relatively easy to take out loans for starting a business or buying a house, although in an ideal scenario, you'd come up with a 20% down payment on a house or apartment to save yourself long-term interest. Low rates mean that even a 5 or 3% down payment could still leave you with a reasonable bill. Your savings are much more likely to fare better in the precious metals market than in, say, a bank certificate of deposit. Just make sure you're not paying for any more loans than you have to. It's probably a good time to refinance any debt, particularly student debt, credit card debt, mortgage debt, because rates are so low. Better yet, prepare for the coming down times by getting out of debt altogether as best you can. Hear that music? It means we're going to take a couple of minutes for a few important announcements. We'll be back. Stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host, Dave Allen. Packages of our latest coin special are still available. We're offering one 1/10 ounce gold American Eagle plus 20 1 ounce silver American Eagles for the ridiculous price of $610, including shipping. You heard right. Just $610, including shipping. Call Carla now, toll free at 1-800-375-4188 while supplies last. Now, home building surged to a 13-year higher in December as activity increased across the board. That suggests the housing market recovery was back on track amid low mortgage rates and could help support the longest economic expansion on record. Housing starts jumped 17% to a seasonally adjusted rate of over 1.6 million units last month. That's the highest level since December 2006. That percentage gain of 17 was the largest since October 2016. Now, economists polled by Reuters had forecast housing starts would increase to a pace just shy of 1.4 million units in December. Housing starts soared over 41% on a year-over-year basis in December. An estimated 1.3 million housing units were started last year, up 3.2% from the prior year. Building permits fell roughly 4% to a rate of 1.4 million units after hitting their highest level in more than 12 and a half years in November. Now, as we've been reporting, the housing market is regaining momentum after the Fed cut interest rates three times last year, pushing down mortgage rates from the previous year's multi-year highs. The 30-year fixed rate has dropped to an average of 3.65% from its peak of 4.94 in November 2018. That's according to Freddie Mac. Though a survey on Monday of this week showed confidence among home builders actually dipping in January, it nevertheless has remained near levels last seen in mid-1999. Builders say they continue to grapple with a shortage of lots and labor, while buyers are frustrated by a lack of inventory, particularly among starter homes. The housing market accounts for about 3.1% of the economy, and residential investment rebounded in the third quarter after contracting for six straight quarters. That's the longest stretch since the financial crisis. Single-family home building, that accounts for the largest share of the housing market, jumped 11%. That's the highest level since June of 2007. Now, job openings plunged to their lowest level in nearly 2 years as hiring surged in November and the employment market got tighter. That is according to the Labor Department, which reported this morning. Total vacancies tumbled by 561,000 job vacancies to 6.8 million for the month. That's the lowest since February 2018, according to the government's Job Openings and Labor Market Turnover Survey, known affectionately as JOLTS. Despite that big drop, openings still outnumbered Americans considered unemployed by nearly 1 million. The vacancy rate nudged down to 4.3%. We'll talk a little bit more. Actually, we're going to talk a lot more about unemployment and low wages right after this. The big decline in openings came during a month when non-farm payrolls increased by 256,000. Total hires increased by 39,000, though the rate was unchanged at 3.8%. That's different from the unemployment rate, obviously, which the government reports was 3.5. Now, on an industry basis, the biggest drops in job openings came in retail, which decreased by 139,000, and construction, which was down 112,000. Common sense should tell you that indeed, after an 11-year run of economic growth, that many companies have hired all the help they need for now. That's Chris Rupke, who's the chief financial economist at MUFG Union Bank. He added that today's sharp reduction in jobs available may be telling us that the economy has finally reached full employment. I beg to differ, ladies and gentlemen, and I'll tell you why in a few minutes. The quits rate, that's the total number of employees who left their job voluntarily, rose for the month by 39,000, though the rate as a measure of workers stood unchanged at 2.3%. Quits rate is considered by many economists a strong gauge of worker mobility, as they believe it reflects confidence that employees can find other work elsewhere. Separations also were little changed, with a drop of 4,000 keeping the rate at 3.7%. Payroll growth also tailed off in December. However, with the department's first estimate showing 145,000 new jobs, these job data have a one-month lag, so December's job openings aren't yet available. Now, our latest blog that is out as we speak is about unemployment and low-paying jobs. You can subscribe to our free weekly blogs and newsletters at dgscoins.com or read them on our Facebook page, at DGS Coins. That's the at sign DGS Coins, one word. The federal government claims that the headline unemployment rate in the U.S. is at a 50-year low. But Gina Belli of Payscale.com said that doesn't mean necessarily that workers are thriving. In fact, Belli points to a recent analysis from the Brookings Institution showing that close to half of all U.S. workers hold low-paying jobs. Close to half. Perhaps just as important, the report notes that over half of those low-wage workers seem destined to stay in low-paying jobs because of their levels of education, training, and other limiting factors. What is the actual unemployment rate? Department of Labor would have us believe the nation's unemployment rate is a mere and historic 3.5%. Well, that's the Bureau of Labor Statistics' so-called U3 headline rate. To be counted as a part of that U3 rate, an individual has to have looked actively for work within the 4 weeks prior to the monthly unemployment survey conducted for the BLS. If the active search for work was in the past year but not in the last 4 weeks, the individual is considered a discouraged worker by the BLS and not counted in the headline labor force. The BLS's U6 rate is the government's broadest measure of unemployment and includes those who have given up looking for work and those who are working part-time but would prefer to work full-time. That U6 rate in December was 6.7%, almost twice as high as the headline rate of 3.5. As most listeners know, many people consider U6 to be the real unemployment rate, although the BLS gives that honor to the U3, which inexplicably is repeated month after month after month by the mainstream media. Now, granted, the U6 rate isn't perfect either, and some analysts believe it's actually too broad for a number of technical reasons, and that the real unemployment rate is probably somewhat a little less than U6. On the other end of the spectrum, there are some like John Williams, who's the founder of ShadowStats.com, who believe the actual unemployment rate is closer to 21%. But that debate's for another time and for other people with better developed brains and longer attention spans than mine. For now, let's just suspend reality for a moment and assume that the headline rate is really 3.5%. Ms. Belli gives some perspective on what that number actually means. The average unemployment rate in the U.S. today is, several decades, is 5.73%. Today's rate is a markedly 40% lower than that. The lowest recorded headline rate was 2.5% in May 1953. The highest rate, recorded in November 82, was 10.8%. The current headline rate of 3.5 has been hovering around that figure since the fall of last year, first hitting the mark in September. It hadn't been that low since 1969. Now, we know there are any number of ways to measure the strength of an economy. The unemployment rate certainly matters, but it's not the only critical factor by far. Pay plays a major role too, and it's a mitigating factor, I believe. Martha Ross and Nicole Bateman, who are the co-authors of the Brookings Report, say nearly half of all workers earn wages that are not enough on their own to promote economic security. With the unemployment rate so low, as misleading as it is, the dominance of low-paying jobs should be surprising. As a rule, most economists expect pay to rise as unemployment declines. As Belli observed, it's the only logical thing, you know, that employers would want to sweeten the deal to attract talent in a tight job market. Unfortunately, it's not working that way for many, many workers. Pardon me. According to the Brookings analysis, about 53 million working Americans between 18 and 64, that's 44% of all workers, are low-wage earners. Their median hourly earnings are $10.22, with median annual earnings of about $18,000. To me, that's a big wow. Belli maintains that this group is just too large to be explained away by the fact that a certain percentage of workers are just starting their careers. Recent or current students, she says, don't add up to 44% of the population. These aren't just people who are looking for extra spending money. Low-wage workers, she says, are primarily adults who work to support themselves and their families. In short, despite officially reported low unemployment, wage stagnation does persist. In December, average hourly earnings for all employees on private non-farm payrolls increased by 2.9% over the previous December. However, real wages, the net value of workers' pay after inflation, well, they've declined almost 10% since 2006, 9.8%. So, even though workers may technically be earning slightly more than they did 14 years ago, their purchasing power doesn't get them nearly as far. But while wage stagnation remains a persistent problem for millions of U.S. workers, it's not an issue for everyone. We know those at the top have actually experienced la-la land-type wage growth despite what's happened with low-wage workers' earnings. CEO pay in particular is rising much faster than worker salaries in recent years, and that only contributes to the economic disparity and the problem of wage stagnation itself. In 2017, the average compensation for CEOs of companies that are listed on the S&P 500 index was $13.9 million. And the average S&P 500 CEO now earns over 350 times more than their average company worker. Belli rightly observes that the full-time employment doesn't necessarily equal financial security. In fact, more than half of families earn less than the U.S. median of $66,465 in household income. It's hard to cover basic survival needs with those kinds of wages, especially a family with one or more children. And it's nearly impossible to put anything into savings. As a result, 40% of Americans report they would struggle to cover an unexpected $400 expense. In those circumstances, one unexpected illness or major car repair could spell a financial crisis. In fact, if not outright disaster for some. Importantly, low wages also make it harder to afford new skills training. It's an important strategy for upward mobility in an increasingly competitive workforce. In fact, Ross and Bateman warn that education alone won't solve the problem. They say, imagine that all working-age adults had bachelor degrees. The jobs paying low wages wouldn't disappear, nor would wages automatically increase. McBelly reminds us that low-wage workers aren't just bringing in extra money. Most are attempting to support themselves and often dependents on their wages, too. She reports that over one quarter, 26% of low-wage workers, that's about 14 million people, are the sole earners in their families. These families are currently attempting to survive on median pay of about $20,000 a year. That's the equivalent of less than $10 an hour in a full-time job. Again, that makes supporting one individual, much less a spouse and children, a big challenge. Now, of course, there is the earned income tax credit that is a help, sometimes a big help to lower income folks. And, you know, because there's so much opposition to increases in the minimum wage, this, I believe, increasing the EITC, I believe, is a much more viable alternative. Now, about a quarter of low-wage workers, that's 13 million people, live in families where all employed persons hold low-paying jobs. Those families have a median income of about $42,000 a year. In short, low unemployment, as dubious as the government's reported figures are, doesn't equal financial security, especially for workers with less skills, less education, and fewer options to retrain for better jobs. As long as the government is in the numbers reporting business, I believe it should convene a panel of specialists with divergent views to come up with a more appropriate and accurate method of calculating and reporting unemployment and other important economic indicators. Now, Monday's American Survival Newsletter article will follow this up by addressing another anomaly in the jobs market, namely how and why increases in minimum wages across the country may be making the labor market look better than it really is. Stay tuned. That music means we're heading into another break. Please stick with us. We'll be back in a few moments. This is Financial Survival.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survivor 5-0. Beg your pardon. I'm your guest host, Dave Allen. Earlier in today's program, we were talking about budget deficits and the debt. The rapid increase of student loan debt has actually slowed over the past few years, but individual borrower balances aren't going down. And that's mostly because hardly anyone is paying down their loans. Total indebtedness over the past year or so has stopped its meteoric rise. That's according to a study that Moody's Investor Service released yesterday. Nevertheless, the study showed a number of factors are holding back borrowers from lightening their loads. Outstanding loans total more than $1.6 trillion now. That's just student loans, more than doubling over the last decade and actually tripling since just 2006. Since the explosion of student debt after the Great Recession, annual repayment rates, or the amount of existing balances lowered, has been just 3%, according to Moody's. Only 51% of borrowers who took out loans from 2010 to 12 have made any progress at all in paying down their debt. While in the past, higher enrollment and rising tuition were the main drivers of growing aggregate student loan balances, more recently, slow repayments have become the primary driver. What's that a function of? It could be several things. More than likely, it's probably been the fact that for several years after the Great Recession, it was very difficult to find a job at all coming out of college, much less a good paying job or a job in one's field of study. So that certainly would be a primary reason why this may be happening. Over the next few years, Moody's continues, the combination of slow repayments and elevated, if no longer growing, levels of new borrowing will likely fuel further increases in outstanding debt. There are multiple reasons why these debt levels are not going down, in addition to the ones I just mentioned. One is that many borrowers are taking advantage of repayment plans based on borrowers' incomes, along with some opting for longer repayment options. Presidential candidates, particularly on the Democratic side, have made reducing or eliminating student debt cornerstones of their campaign. Moody said those kinds of proposals would stimulate the U.S. economy, but have negative effects for some financial institutions. In the meantime, the burden of student loans continues to be felt with an 11% default rate. That's the highest of any debt category. Education also is now second only to mortgages as the highest form of debt for all Americans. Increased reliance on student debt crowds out an individual's access to other forms of household credit when they need it, and that likely delays business formation and home ownership, and certainly important drivers of economic growth and wealth creation. But one indication that the pressure may alleviate, if only a bit, is that the annual growth rate decelerated to 5% in the third quarter of last year. That's down from a peak of 14.7% at the end of 2008. A paper released earlier this week from the St. Louis Fed also looked at the student debt issue. That research noted that debt has grown more rapidly for students in four-year colleges and graduate schools than those in community college, hinting, they believe, that repayment rates could actually accelerate in the not-too-distant future. Now, Moody's Investor Services issued a negative outlook for sovereign creditworthiness in the euro area for this year, downgrading the block from stable the same time last year. The report published earlier this week cited the deteriorating global environment and suggested that euro area economies are vulnerable to rising protectionism and geopolitical risks, with their ability to handle economic shocks inhibited. Certainly no surprise on the one hand. Well, the annual report is an update to the markets and not a formal ratings action. It highlighted a number of factors that heighten the risk of investing in the debt of euro area economies this year in particular. Moody's determined that political fragmentation in many countries is hindering reform and will likely slow policy responses to domestic or external shocks, with minority and multi-party coalition governments becoming the new norm and political divergence increasing at the EU level. Moody said, our negative outlook for the euro area reflects most member states' limited buffers to react to a worsening external environment. The deteriorating global environment will weigh on growth in member states' open economies in 2020, although resilient domestic demand, easy monetary policy, and some fiscal easing will mitigate that impact. Still, high public debt ratios are also projected to restrict governments' fiscal room to maneuver in the event of a sharp slowdown, with monetary policy close to having exhausted its effectiveness. You have Belgium, Cyprus, France, Greece, Italy, Portugal, and Spain. All have debt ratios around 100% of GDP, or actually significantly higher in some cases. That's unprecedented for the last few decades and significantly restricts their ability to use fiscal policy anyway to cushion a sharp slowdown in growth. Weak global trade is expected to continue to stymie exports and growth, while Germany's industrial weakness, Moody's believes, will spill over into the rest of the euro area. Its economists expect modest GDP growth of 1.2% for the euro area in 2020. Compared to 1.1 in 2019. Pardon me. Donald Trump, who we know is a persistent critic of the Federal Reserve for keeping interest rates higher than he'd like, yesterday picked two economists for the Fed who are seen as advocates for the looser policies he wants. Christopher Waller, who's research director at the St. Louis Fed's, a specialist in monetary policy, works closely with that bank president, James Bullard. Bullard, in fact, was one of the Fed's most vocal supporters of lower interest rates last year, and has said Waller shares his views on policy. Before joining the Fed in 2009, Waller was an economics professor at the University of Notre Dame. Shelton is a far less conventional pick, with views that could draw scrutiny from senators who are required to confirm Fed nominees. She's a former Trump campaign advisor. Importantly, she's advocated for a return to the gold standard. But that's a move that Fed policymakers, anyway, have said would limit the Fed's flexibility to fight inflation and boost employment. Some might suggest that given the economy's return to a gold standard, there just might not be any inflation to worry about. Shelton's railed against loose Fed policy in the past, but since last summer, when her name was first floated as a potential pick, she's echoed the president's call for lower rates. She's also urged closer coordination between the Fed, the White House, and the Congress. We know the Fed closely guards its political independence as key to its ability to act in the best interest of the country's economic health rather than at the behest of any one administration. This isn't the first time the president has tried to shape the world's most powerful central bank to his liking. But if these two most recent picks are confirmed by the Senate, he will have installed 6 of the Fed's 7 governors. Certainly a significant feat in this day and age. Fed policymakers include the 7-member Fed board, plus the 12 presidents of the Fed bank's regional outpost, picked not by the president, but by their local boards of directors. All right, let's see where we can go next. Just bear with me for a moment. Sorry for the dead air space. Well, here we go. Let's just do some end-of-the-week news briefs. First, Alphabet is the parent of Google. Topped $1 trillion in market value yesterday, solidifying the dominance of technology and internet stocks. Only two other U.S. names are on or past that threshold: Apple, which has a value of about $1.4 trillion, and Microsoft, $1.3. Amazon passed $1 trillion in 2018, but now is just under the 13-digit mark. Together, these four companies are by far the largest on Wall Street, and their huge size gives them an outsized impact on overall market direction. Together, they represent more than 15% of the weight of the S&P 500. The fifth largest U.S. stock by market cap, Facebook, currently has a valuation of about $633 billion. Now, the biggest company outside the tech or internet sector, that's Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, in sixth place, around $559 billion. Globally, the list is topped by Saudi Aramco, which, as you know, went public last month and currently has a market cap of roughly $1.8 trillion. Now, it used to be we worried about a day when the government might own most of the means of production. Today, I believe the bigger worry should be commerce being tied up and controlled by mega companies like the ones we just mentioned. Next, too big to fail Wall Street or Citigroup today will announce a $150 million Citi Impact Fund to invest in private sector companies with positive impact on society. This falls under the category of credit where credit is due, although let's see the outcomes. The global bank says it will invest its own capital in U.S. companies that are innovating in workforce development, access to the financial system, physical and social infrastructure like housing, healthcare, transportation, and sustainability like energy and water. Microsoft has pledged to become carbon negative by 2030 by removing more carbon from the environment than it emits, not just across our direct emissions, but across our supply chain, according to CEO Satya Nadella. Microsoft added that by 2050, the company will remove from the environment all the carbon the company has emitted either directly or by electrical consumption since it was founded in 1975. Certainly lofty but worthy goals. Back in Washington, the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO, it's a nonpartisan agency that works for Congress, has found that the White House Office of Management Budget violated federal law under the direction of the president when it withheld congressionally approved U.S. aid to Ukraine in the summer of last year. Not surprisingly, OMB disputes the GAO findings. The Senate approved the president's U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement late yesterday, handing the president a major political win on the same day senators happened to be sworn in as jurors in his impeachment trial. And while the impact of UMSCA on the U.S. economy is projected to be small, Trump can now claim trade victories with 5 of the U.S.'s top 6 trading partners: Canada, China, Japan, Mexico, South Korea. left out so far, the European Union and the UK itself when they leave the EU, but they're next in line. And across the Atlantic, the EU trade chief pulled no punches. Phil Hogan described our president as obsessed with a U.S. deficit in goods with the EU and urged him to take into account services, where it has a $60 billion surplus. Hogan said between now and the November elections, this is what Mr. Trump is thinking about. Now, there's no mention of tariffs on cars during his visits, and the two sides are discussing digital service taxes. In my mind, here's the next trade war, ladies and gentlemen. It might not last as long as the U.S.-China, although that resolution is a long way off. But I think there's more tension just over the horizon. Now, finally, a dead lamb thrown from a helicopter into a swimming pool made a big splash in Argentina. A video showing the carcass hurtling into the home of mogul Federico Alvarez Castillo, as onlookers giggled, prompted a furious debate over decadence and inequality at a time of economic crisis in that country. Castillo refused to say who dropped the lamb or why, but did acknowledge that he and his family pulled it from the pool and grilled it. Now that's what I call making lemonade out of a lemon. That's all the time we have for today's program. I appreciate so much your tuning in, and look forward to having Melody back with us on Monday. I'm Dave Allen. Have a good weekend.